Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Preparing for the LDT Upheaval, One Company's Experience with Regulatory Discretion. The presenter is Don Rule, MBA, CEO, Translational Software, Mercer Island, Washington.
My name is Don Rule. I have a little software company that is on a mission to democratize precision medicine. So our software takes genetic test results and transforms it into actionable intelligence for doctors that enables them to know when medication might be either more or less effective or potentially toxic for a patient. We've had some recent interactions with the FDA that might foreshadow what we're all in for with the LDT, and Robert thought that might be of interest to other people here. My original title for this was Preparing for the LDT Apocalypse. I decided I might back that off a little bit. For the title slide, I asked ChatGPT for a picture of a high-speed train about to have a terrible accident. But ChatGPT said, I'm here to promote a positive and safe content, so I can't create that. And that may be good advice for all of us. It's the first time I've been admonished by AI. But that might be good advice for all of us to sort of calm down a little bit and see what we can do with the rule that we have. So pharmacogenetics is the ideal test case for this rule because it represents, you know, this is not your father's lipid test. It represents something that does have the level of complexity that they're concerned about. So from our perspective, you don't need me to tell you what the SNPs of COVID are. But pharmacogenetics is an interesting problem for a software person to solve. For the FDA, there's a very low state of awareness among doctors. If you ask your dentist, they certainly know that 10% of the time codeine doesn't work for people, but it's very few of them know why. From the standpoint of the processing that has to happen, an interesting part about pharmacogenetics is you want to know what the activity of the enzyme is. And it's not uncommon that you have multiple deleterious variants within the same gene. And knowing whether they're on the same strand or not, being able to infer that, makes a difference between an accurate recommendation and inaccurate. Great for software nerds. From the FDA's standpoint, PGX is at the intersection of lab testing, which they want to regulate, and drugs, which give them a good reason to. For us, this represents technical term for it is a double whammy. So FDA will start by creating a precedent. They've been interested in regulating labs for 20 years or more. The precedent they went after was 23andMe because they were also direct to consumer. So very important to make sure that the content is corrected. They started talking to 23andMe in 2009. 2013, they felt that the 23andMe was not responding, and they actually shut them down. 23andMe didn't come back onto the market with many of their tests until 2015, and in 2019, they actually created a PMA, a 510K for pharmacogenetics. This set the precedent. Our life began, our regulatory life began in 2016. By 2015, if we look at CMS data, about 60% of the reimbursed tests for CMS were processed by labs that were customer of ours. So we were an obvious target. I learned yesterday that there is a technical term for this letter. It is the "It has come to our attention" letter. But something to be learned from this is you may think of your website as just happy talk. They think of it as claims. And that's very important, and that's how they find us. So anyway, this slide actually comes from this conference in 2017. Our head was spinning at that time saying, okay, there's CLIA, there's CAP, there's FDA, and now for many of you, there's MolDX as well to take into account. So after getting that letter, we talked to the FDA. I tried to get us in under a class one device that was running at Partners Healthcare. They said that's not available to you and you're not class one. They think of it as class two, and I never really argued with that very much. So in December, we put in a de novo submission that included both the software as well as our content. In December, within a day or two, the 21st Century Cures Act passed. And an interesting carve-out in the 21st Century Cures Act is something called clinical decision support. So the thought is if you can provide to the physician information that allows them to recreate the recommendation you have, and you're fully transparent about it, then that is something that doesn't fall under regulation. I found out later that is something the FDA argued against, but they lost that argument. So in March 17, they came back to us and said, please note at this point in time, your knowledge base is not a priority for review by CDRH. Now, there are the two pieces of FDA, CDRH, the devices, and CDER, which is the drugs. CDER didn't necessarily agree with it. We don't really know between CDER and CDRH. It's very, very difficult to know what their varying opinions are on anything. But in April, so essentially we went forward after the 2017 meeting. We went back to the drawing board and said, we recreated a submission. We went through a level of review. We made a mistake in April 2018 where our camp chart, for some reason, had a wrong submission date in it. So essentially we were locking down to submit, and all of a sudden an email popped up saying that our submission had been withdrawn. So I called immediately. And said, what's up with this? It took me a week, and essentially I emailed saying, yeah, I can get this in today. It took a week to get a call. By the time we got that call, they said, no, that was killed a week ago. The lesson from this is it's better to get forgiveness than permission. I have a suspicion that if we had just sent it in, that they would have reviewed it. Because we asked for permission, they were, you know, we asked them to tell us directly that they would bend the rules. There are many times that they've given us forgiveness. So 2019, after the 23andMe submission, there was sort of an awakening on the part of FDA. In April, one thing I should state is that we never got to the point of a warning. We always made sure we never wanted that warning. So in 2019, the FDA went to ANOVA and said, and the scuttlebutt at the time was that this all came about because of a huge banner that ANOVA put in the right field fence of a Washington Nationals game. And that was very visible to the FDA. But anyway, FDA said to ANOVA, that kind of looks like direct-to-consumer, which they could have fixed. We think that comes under our jurisdiction. They went to an aggressive outside attorney who came back and said, no, this is not under your jurisdiction. And the FDA said, yes, it is. And that was the end of that. ANOVA decided it wasn't worth pursuing, but partially because they had other tests they wanted to get through the FDA. They didn't want to poison the well. So in June 2019, it was never explicitly said between us and FDA that we were the content provider for ANOVA, but we assume they know. So we got a meeting in 2019, first of all, not exempt under 21st Century Cures Act. That wasn't a surprise. Haplotyping, I had worked to change the architecture of it so that rather than it being an algorithm, I had been told that FDA is allergic to algorithms, it was a lookup. Essentially, give me this set of SNPs, and it will look up what, so you can predetermine what the tables are, you can validate the tables. They said, no, that's still a medical device, it's still subject to regulation. The big shocker here, one of two, is that the content would be regulated. Essentially, they said that we changed our mind since 2016. We've seen some issues in the marketplace where people are making claims that are not healthy, and they said we need to regulate the content. What was really painful was that they said the CPIC guidelines that are essentially the experts in this field were not, quote, regulatory grade. They were developed under NIH funding. They certainly followed what they thought were good processes, but FDA did not consider them regulatory grade. So this means that CPIC, which had maybe 10 years of operation at that point, tens of millions of dollars of investment in it, and thousands of volunteer hours, of which hundreds were from my company, that we couldn't use that. We had to recreate it. So we had to go out and go to the primary literature for all that information and kind of recreate those recommendations. So they said we would need, you know, either a PMA or a 510K, and helpfully they said, well, the 23andMe 510K may work for you. We were kind of shocked by that because we're not, you know, we don't have any asparagus tests. We consider ourselves very different from 23andMe, but heck, it was their idea, so we went for it. And that was, you know, pure on their side, they were really trying to help us. On our side, that turned out to be, because we were not a lab, that was kind of a fool's errand. The other thing that was frightening at about this time was a couple of their press releases. The first one said there was no relationship between DNA variations and the effectiveness of antidepressants. It's absolutely, I don't think there was anybody in the field that would have agreed with that. And in fact, I couldn't find it for this presentation, but I have another quote from Francis Collins at the same time saying, we think this is part, this is one of the most promising areas. So lesson from that is your view of the world depends very much on your business model. The business model of FDA was they get their information from drug companies. Drug companies don't have a strong reason to keep people from taking their medications. So this is what their belief was. On the Francis Collins side, they funded millions of dollars worth of extramural research that created this information. So as part of that, they explicitly called out escitalopram and sertraline, and that was a head-scratcher for us and for everybody else. So we went into that 2019 meeting with, you know, a ream of data that we've sent ahead of time, and we said we want to talk about this and find out what your feeling is. And we explicitly asked for the CDER people to be in that meeting, and they were not. But essentially, we you know, presented the data in a presentation, and Tim Stenzel said, you have to understand that there are some things that are learned during the submission process that are not public data. And I remember walking out of the building that day, we got out, we closed the door behind us, looked at each other, and somebody said, we're screwed. So the other thing that was alarming about this was some of the content of these press releases were specifically designed to create harm to the reputation of Inova. It was very aggressive. So the learning from that was at the working level, our working relationship with FDA has been terrific. They're really good, very helpful, everything else. At the senior level, they're pretty Machiavellian. So we put a submission in February 2020. They were anxious for us to get that data, that information, that in as soon as possible. So that included 7 genes and 27 drugs, which is about a little less than, a little more than 10% of the set of drugs that were relevant. Very annoying was within days of that, the FDA published their table of pharmacogenic associations. So we were killing ourselves going back to the literature to create this content, and they were independently working on it and never told us. First problem in the submission feedback, the 510K is based on a set of special controls. The first special controls were around the sensitivity and specificity of the lab. Our first submission said, well, we work with labs that are both CAP, both CLIA and CAP. And CAP has proficiency testing for pharmacogenetics, which is not ideal, but it's functioning well, I think, for many labs now. What they said was that's not good enough. We have to guarantee the validity of the results that we get from the lab. So I heard Bill Gates say once, the difference between God and the Oracle founder is that God doesn't think he's the Oracle founder. The difference between us and the FDA is we know we don't want to regulate labs. They were essentially looking at us as a proxy to go out and do that. If in hindsight, if we had partnered up with a company that could do that third-party evaluation of the lab, that might have gone further. Our experience at the time with the New York State Laboratory review was they were not particularly friendly to software. They wanted us to put a wet lab director. They wanted us to hire that wet lab director. We didn't really see that that was a useful thing for us. Lately, we've been talking to a company called Beanstalk, and they're actually a third-party reviewer for a lot of FDA tests. So that may be an opportunity for us going forward. Okay, so CAP and CLIA not sufficient. So the other thing they came back with is it's not just the drug gene information that has to be validated. It is the individual variant level information. We have to prove the clinical validity, clinical utility of those variants. So not just CPIC did we have to recreate, but the but PharmGKB, which had 15 years and tens of millions of dollars also, we had to recreate that as well. We put revisions in April 2021, and if you remember where you were in April 2021, our 2020 was in complete free fall. Most labs had moved to COVID testing, and those that didn't were not getting a lot of samples because people weren't going to the doctor. So there were exactly 3 people in the company. One of them helpfully was brilliant, and we got a submission in 2021. We went through a round of feedback. We were recreating the company and you'll notice the time span here. They actually granted several extensions that we never even asked for. And the fact is if we sent it in, they wouldn't go do it anyway at that time. But we finally did the final submission on October 15th. We got back the answer in August. We are now issuing a not substantially equivalent decision and expect you to cease marketing and distributing your device. That was difficult. I spent September working with legal, seeing if we had any way around it, calling down all of our customers. One of our customers thought that they could come up with an alternative by December 12th. We got agreement from the FDA to operate through the end of the year. On January 1st, our system came down. So, what were the issues in our submission? First of all, we never came up with a way. We tried to do something creative, like saying, okay, there's a quality score on the data that gets sent to us. So we'll take that quality score and see whether it's, see whether the data's. And they said, well, that doesn't prove that the samples weren't mixed. I said, sorry, I just can't help you with that. They were absolutely right in that our validation information was insufficient. We just didn't have the right team in place to do it at that time. Likewise, the variant analysis, gene drug information was, in the words of the reviewer, a mess. There were things that were just between submissions, just didn't get updated. It was about 2,000 pages on the content side alone, let alone the software variation. The real irony is they felt that our comprehension study was underpowered, and we had really spent literally thousands of hours on our report and were well known in the industry for having the most lucid reports. When we went back to look at this, the people who did the comprehension study for us had doctors. They thought to do it properly, you use doctors, pharmacists, and nurses. As it turned out, the nurses, when asked what they would do with this report, said, well, I'd bring it to a pharmacist, which is the right answer, but that was considered a failure of their comprehension of the test, which we'll know better. What are the mistakes we made? We could see pretty early on that it was really difficult for us to solve all the problems of the lab and us. I don't know that we had a really an alternative at this time. Believe me, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I don't see how we could have done it under the predicate that we had. Secondly, timing, not good. Planning around a pandemic was not a good idea. Funding, trying to fund the regulatory initiative based on a commercial service, that funding, I spent about $862,000 on consulting just between 2020 and last year. And it really wasn't enough. And part of the reason it wasn't enough is we're a servant of two masters. We tried to be the SaaS product that did what customers wanted and tried to do the software as a medical device that FDA wanted at the same time. So moving forward, how do I want to, I hope, move forward? So the issues to resolve, lab validation, variant content, haplotyping, gene drug content. So the problem with the variants is the underpowered nature, is the when we look at our predicates, the predicate, the earliest example we had that we had saved a life was a transplant patient in New Jersey who was failing. They were losing the patient. In desperation, they got a pharmacogenetic test for them. They found out that the voriconazole that they were taking to fight infection was not working. They changed the medication and saved the patient. If you look at the label for our predicate, if that person were Latino, 14% of the time they would have missed that variant. When I look at my data, our data is about 1.5, 1.6 million tests that we've processed. The 2D6 that they cleared does not include structural variation for CYP2D6, which is really important. 17% of the time, when I look at what we've covered, that would mean a false negative for the patient. And the problem here is that FDA doesn't recognize either PharmGKB or AMP. AMP, Association for Molecular Pathology, has a good list of tier one, tier two variants that you should include. If we could just throw that in, we would have been fine. And again, that represents a tremendous amount of work. So the other thing is drug gene content. The FDA doesn't recognize CPIC. They said to us you should limit the dosing recommendation to reports and general statements restricted to the dosing language included in the FDA's table of pharmacogenetic associations.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
17% were false negative.
Yeah. This was of all the samples that we've looked at. When I look to see... Well, that's why the label statement for 2C19 was around Latinos, that it's for them, it's 14%, that it would be false negatives. But that gene is where the lawsuit came in Hawaii, that... people were prescribing clopidogrel, Plavix, didn't take into account that it may not be metabolized to its active form by the patient, and since they had have a high number of Pacific Islanders in Hawaii, that was considered not good practice. Yeah. This was just for everybody. And when you look at the BRCA test, Invitae separately did their own testing and said, based on the variants that they saw, 90% of people who were subject to BRCA mutations would not have been caught by the FDA-cleared test. So anyway, what they're suggesting is use a table of pharmacogenetic associations. So the problem with that is the very first criteria of the Cures Act is that it has to be transparent. In other words, the physician has to be able to recreate the content that you've provided and see if they understand why you came up to that relationship and what really matters. My clicker has a mind of its own here. So they have no references. There are no clear evidentiary standards for what they provide. There's no published SOPs for how they came up with that information. And we looked at it, and there are 24 drugs that are reimbursed by CMS. In other words, CMS considers the evidence sufficient that don't exist on the table of pharmacogenetic associations. So here's an example for intermediate metabolizer of CYP2D6 being considered for prescribed amitriptyline. The table of the TOPA says it may alter systemic concentrations. Not sure what a doctor does with that. But if you look at CPIC and Dutch Pharmacogenetic Working Group, they have a similar, reduce the dosage and monitor more carefully. So essentially, the recommendation that you give, if you are doing rounds at Mayo Clinic or Vanderbilt or St. Jude, are different from the recommendations you would give if you're working out of an office in Bethesda. And it's hard to get around this. Now, if all science is either physics or stamp collecting, pharmacogenetics is kind of in another world. You know, certainly we know some basic principles about how things work, but we're a long way from having an algorithm or formula that would allow us to predict exactly how things work in the body. But here's an example that the clinical trial for this drug, which I am not going to try to pronounce, the clinical trial was done with one particular haplotype of UGT1I1, that's known to be a decreased function allele. Now, other guidelines will look at other decreased function alleles and provide similar guidance. The FDA, again, coming from the drug side, has a policy of completely empirical evidence. So something that a physician would potentially want to know about that gene is not published under the table of pharmacogenetics. So the question is, what is more dangerous? So to say, is it really safer to know that there's another variation there that's likely problematic and not say anything, or to say that this is possibly a problem and rate the evidence as lower than this? So the thing that's kind of irked us is, for drug-drug interactions, it's about a $250 million market. You can go to WebMD or anywhere and essentially look up drug-drug interactions. I've never seen anything explained exactly why is it that the FDA doesn't regulate. First, the FDA relies on data provided by the pharmaceutical companies, which may not be up to date. Secondly, we're learning new stuff all the time. Third, it's not in the FDA's charter to educate doctors. And I've always been appalled at how much drug companies spend for marketing after hiring two salespeople who had worked in the pharmaceutical industry. I realized that an awful lot of that cost is educational. But this is a case of sort of genetic exceptionalism. You know, in the case of drug-drug interactions, they don't regulate, but in the case of drug-gene interactions, they feel compelled to control the information. So I have a modest proposal for how to move forward, and I hope I get somewhere with it. First, in the software world and in engineering, there's a concept of separation of concerns. If you have a complex problem, you break it down into modules and say each module can be independently tested and proven. My experience with this at Microsoft was TCP IP, when I got to Redmond in January of 1995, we were expecting the Microsoft network to be on the internet by December of that year. Well, it turned out a couple of really smart French developers had implemented this transport layer over AOL. So we popped that out, we popped in TCP IP, and that went in the box in July of 1995. And in 14 years at Microsoft, that's the only thing I ever saw that shipped even on time. But if you think, if you regulate a medical device the way we, if you regulated the internet the way we were asked to regulate, any time that Intel changed their firmware, Google would have to revalidate. I think there's a better way to do this. And the first would be to say, let's separate the wet lab from the dry lab, because they actually do different things. So the laboratory would be responsible for analytic validity. The software would be responsible for making sure that the translation from genotypes to clinical phenotypes is done properly. And then the third would be, let's break out the clinical decision support and make that available. So the first part of it would be to say, obviously we can't verify the results from the lab, but what if the lab were doing the IVD? So labs could do an IVD for the, better yet, the people who manufacture the kits that get sent out there could do an IVD. Last week when the the notification came from Agena that said, this is, you know, you're selling this as RUO, but it's really an IVD. I sent that to Vicky Pratt at Agena, said, welcome to the party. So we could set, you know, whether it's AMP or whatever else, say, here's a set of variants that are important to pharmacogenetics, and if you want to build a panel, this is a suggestion on what they're built on. I asked Tim Stenzel yesterday, and it would not be incumbent on the laboratory to prove clinical utility, only analytical validity. So they could essentially create a kit that was that. And actually, I've been lobbying the Thermo and Agena, I've been working for 2 years actually to find someone who can put together a sequencing kit that would be a targeted PGX kit. So talk about, you know, what are the protocols for verifying the accuracy, point to public available biospecimens to test, and then engage third-party reviewers to the extent it's necessary to work with labs or the manufacturers through that process. The second is haplotyping. What we tried to do is define a standard operating procedure that would allow us to create a panel, create a translation for any panel that any lab might send to us. So over time, out of, say, 300 labs, I would say, and part of the reason I think the IVD is not such a bad idea is probably 50% take the off-the-shelf panel from the manufacturer. There are cases where there are sort of vanity panels that add variants or drugs that wouldn't be on a standard panel. So if we confine ourselves to the IVDs and we say, oh, okay, maybe we just cover, you know, the two kits that are covered by manufacturers, we can simplify this problem. What would be interesting in what 23andMe did recently was they created a predetermined change control plan, agreed up front that as the information we have evolves, this is their validation process for incorporating new information. That's actually that's quite interesting for us. And then what we would do is map the clinical phenotypes to the table of pharmacogenetic associations. That's not sufficient information for the doctor to act on, but at least it would tell them when there's something to know. And then the next step would be separately implement a clinical decision support system. So we take the clinical phenotypes, push it to Epic or the pharmacy system or whatever else, and from there they can either build a clinical decision support system or we can provide an external one for them. So that's my theory of how to move forward to live within the IVD rule, the LDT rule, move that to IVD, create a separate regulated device that is haplotyping, and then enable us to push clinical decision support out to the and in this scenario, this essentially is covered under practice of medicine. It's not necessarily something that would be an FDA. So things to keep in mind. FDA's toolbox is limited. They've got a very big hammer, and if you're not a nail, it hurts. Secondly, if you look at what the FDA people do, they're incredibly smart, but they may be working on buccal swabs one day and MRIs the next. So when you deal with them, you have to be able to speak in the process language that they're used to. The harmonization around 13845 is, I think, really an interesting new thing that we can work with. They have no mandate that you should be commercially successful. And in fact, they kind of are used to living in a world where the thing that finally gets approved has a patent involved with it, so it can garner an awful lot of revenue. In our world, most of that information is public. It'd be very difficult to patent it, and we had the extra problem that our revenue is probably anywhere from 5 to 10% of what the labs is. You know, essentially our cost to them is radically less than the revenue they bring in. You know, I heard something about that recently. There was a Myriad decision many years ago that essentially said they couldn't patent, but I heard something to the effect that that's being reviewed.
Modified, yeah.
Yeah.
But still, there's this tell hanging over the whole field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not really published. Most of them are actually already
in domain. That's a good point. You know, if you have CPIC recommendations that have been funded by NIH that have been in the public domain for 10 years, I'm not sure. Now, where that might come in, a company like Myriad, their recommendations came originally from Mayo Clinic. Some of those they did not make public. So they could potentially say, that call it a process patent or something like that. Yeah. Very important that once you have submitted or even talked about submitting, you have made essentially you're admitting that you are a medical device, and there's no going back after that. There is, in any FDA process, there is a least burdensome. Essentially, you can say, you know, is this the least burdensome way to go about this. We thought about that early on. A lawyer said, boy, I would love to work on that for you, but you can't afford it. So don't try to shoehorn a predicate. It's much harder, from our perspective, to validate legacy code. Essentially, what I'm doing now is refactoring all my code so the validation process can be much easier. Q-subs, FDA, absolutely, they invite you to do question sessions. You have to use those really, really intelligently. A mistake we always made was to try to get more questions in there than we really wanted to. But our experience is, no matter what you ask, in the end, there's an open discussion about it. And when you want to get a decision, they say, well, why don't you submit it? We'll let you know. That is a really expensive process of iterating towards something that works. Narrow the scope. There's a concept in computer security to reduce the attack surface. Narrow the scope of what you're doing so it is, you know, just what's essential. And move, as we want to do with clinical decision support, move it outside the regulatory boundary. The eSTAR is essentially the submission tool for sending it in. It's really just a big PDF. We were working with a couple of different consultants on the content side as well as the software side. We assumed that tool was just to package things up. In fact, it is prescriptive in terms of the documents you should have. There were two documents we should have, that we hadn't prepared. So that was a very, very long night. I don't know enough about the PCCP yet, but I'm going to investigate because that could be really the thing we always worried about from the beginning. Well, first of all, would even if we got approved, would what we did be commercially viable? And my sense is no. But if we have the predetermined change control platform process, can we go out with something that's really small and narrow and build on it over time? And then investing in tooling. We many years ago looked at a quality management system. It was $40,000. We said, geez, that's a lot. And implemented in SharePoint, probably a mistake. There is, on the development side, something I'm really excited about, is we used to use Jira. We're in Azure DevOps now. But there's a tool that goes over the top of it that helps you. It allows you, when you're putting together requirements, to use AI and create those requirement documents. And often it will think about requirements that you didn't think of, including security. You know, it kind of has the checklist for you of what are the the things. I, in like 2 hours, I created 24 pages of requirements, and 17 of them were pretty good. But what's really exciting is the ability to say, I've got an epic, I've got a feature, I've got a requirement, and I've got a test case for it, and there'll be another column for, did this test case succeed? Well, when our requirements documents, when our requirements documents were in Word, when you wanted to change anything about the test cases that were associated, it was an enormous amount of work. This is really, I'm really excited about this. So, pharmacogenetics, perfect example of a complex test that should be regulated in some way. The current regulated tests are not what you would consider, no commercial lab would do that. Anytime since 2014, we've required any of our customers to come up with a minimum level of variations that were tested. And we would not have accepted that predicate. Applying the current regulatory framework to pharmacogenetics, incredibly expensive. So maybe a Myriad, maybe a GenoMind, or OneOhm could afford to do it. But I think even they, under the constraints we were under, there would be some content that they provide that they consider useful that would not be allowed by the FDA. So compartmentalizing this issue is, I think, the way to go forward in saying, let's separate out the functions that have to be done and evaluate them individually in terms of the quality and the efficacy of what they do. So my plan is to move forward. We're a very small team right now. I'm actively looking for people to work with me on this plan. So if you know of anyone you might be interested. What was really interesting is to find out that there's a carve-out for VA and IDNs in the current rule. So that may give us some breathing room to actually get our feet under us and then go in. The ideal for me is to find a collaborator on the lab side and on the IVD side and potentially on the clinical decisions board side. We have running in Arkansas Children's Hospital now, our content is in their Epic system. We have a prototype for Epic being able to call out to our decision support and provide best practice advisories for what you should do, either should you order a test or if you've had a test, what's the relevance for it. So anyway, we're looking for collaborators to work with us on that. Ideally, what I'd like to do is go into the FDA with a pre-sub that kind of presents this concept. And I think if we got some clear direction from the FDA that this approach would be worthwhile, then that one might be an opportunity to raise some money to bring it forward. That's where we are. Thank you very much.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.